Going around the horseshoe, we have Judy Abraham, who is the head of salaries with Richer Sounds, the retailer. We have Fiona Wilson, who is head of research and economics at Usdaw. Also on the task force, she'll be joined by John Hammett, who is the general secretary of Usdaw, who isn't with us today. We have Norman Pickabouts, who, as I said, will be addressing us in a few moments. Norman was for some time the HR director for Morrison's and is now a senior executive with Grant Thornton, the accountants. Then we have Jill Rubery, who is professor of comparative employment systems at University of Manchester. Daniel Johnson, who wears two hats. His main hat for the purposes of this task force is as managing director of a small retailer, Studio One and Paper Type Group, but he is also a Labour Party candidate in the forthcoming Scottish parliamentary elections. And then finally, we have Jeremy is standing in for Anita Clark from the IPA, very kindly. She can't be with us, but you're going to say a few words about the IPA's interested in this subject. After background introductions, let me hand over to the project researcher Cameron Tate to talk us through some of the evidence that has really led us to this point, that why we want to do this project.
Brilliant, thanks a lot, Andy. The reason why we're a couple of minutes late here just now is that we just had our first meeting of the task force. So I'm quickly just having to tweak my presentation in light of all the comments made by the members of the task force. But I'm just going to give a sort of couple of minutes overview of the terms that we're looking at here. What is productivity? Looking at the UK productivity performance and looking at productivity and pay in the retail sector and looking forward at what the task force is going to be looking at and things that we might be saying in the end. So first of all, what is productivity? Well, we've just had a very long discussion about that, but here's a quote from Paul Krugman, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist. Productivity isn't everything, but in the long run, it is almost everything. A country's ability to improve its standard of living over time depends almost entirely on its ability to raise its output worker. And this has been made sort of more relevant recently, as Dan was talking about. Another Nobel Prize winning economist, Christopher Serenis, warned that the UK, unless it's able to boost productivity, George Osborne's national living wage is going to end up in job losses and failure. But what exactly is productivity? I mean, put very simply, it's the ratio between output input, the rate at which a worker, a company, or a country produces goods or services, and the amount produced compared with how much time, work, and money is needed to produce them. But when we look at productivity in the retail sector, it's very difficult to measure. Sales are an obvious point to measure for output, but what about excellent customer service? What about the benefits to society that retailers, and particularly in store retail, gives to? But look, why does this matter? And it matters because productivity and living standards are very closely linked, and there's a consensus amongst economists that when productivity levels rise, income per capita, the main measure for living standards, rises too. And there's a chart just behind me which sort of clearly shows the correlation between productivity and living standards. But in countries that have high levels of living standards, they tend to have high levels of productivity too, and vice versa. And this is important because right now the UK productivity performance is in the doldrums. It tailed off at the financial crisis. It was rising by about 2% every year until 2008, and it tailed off after that. And it's slightly upset now, but we're still well below the blue line, which is the pre-crisis trend of about 2% a year. And that's why this is such a big issue for economists. So why are we looking specifically at the retail sector? Because the retail sector is special. It's the biggest private sector employer in the UK, so there are 3 million employees. And the performance of the retail industry is just one of the key reasons why the UK had lower unemployment over the course of the crisis. And it's also one of the only industries, we were talking about this earlier, where you can get people that will start right at the bottom, stacking shelves, like Sir Terry Leakey at Tesco's or Dave Potter's now at Morrison's, who will make it all the way up to the boardroom to be running the show. So it's a special industry, but it's also a centre for low-paid work. And on the measures that we've got, there's a chart behind me, low productivity too. Now, take in mind the sort of warnings that I sounded about productivity there. But one and a half million people in the retail sector are in low pay, around 39% of staff. And on productivity, it compares, in terms of these measures, badly against other UK industries and badly against retail industries abroad too. So what are we going to look at? In terms of ways forward, we're going to be looking at how retailers and government can help retailers to improve pay productivity together, to be able to reward employees well, but get the best out of them too. And there are some examples here, and it's fantastic. We've got two employers on the task force that are living wage retailers who've both gone through the journey of realising that they wanted to pay their staff well and more, and change the operations and the way they run those businesses in order to be able to do that. We'll also look at other industries like the security industry, which has graduated out of originally being seen by the Low Pay Commission as a low paying industry and now isn't anymore. And we'll look abroad as well to other countries where there's a higher productivity, higher pay model for retail staff. So that's a quick introduction to the task force and what we're looking at.
Cameron, thank you very much. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce the chair of the task force, Norman Nicholas.
Thank you very much, and hello to everybody here. We've had our first meeting this morning, and I think we're going to have a lot of very interesting discussions about what is, I think, the central topic for future competitiveness of the UK. I thought I'd start with a little story from my own background in retail. When I joined Morrison's as hired by Mark Holland, now Mark Spencer's as chief executive, but Ken Morrison, the son of the founder, had become chairman, and he decided that he would give me a personal induction to the business, a proper retail induction. So we went to a store in Yorkshire in Weatherby, and we walked in, and he approached this young lad who was putting lettuces out on the fresh veg section, and Ken stops him and says, "Hey lad, what's your job?" And the lad said, "Stocks." "What's it?" "So what?" I'm sacking these lettuces." He said, "No, but what's your job?" He thought for a second. He said, "Well, I work in the grocery department." He said, "What's your job?" And the lad by this stage was completely dumbfounded by Sir Ken Morrison. And Morrison said, "You're in sales. That's what you're in. You're in sales." And the reason for sharing that story is because retail in many ways comes down to some really fundamental things. You know, you're buying things, you're selling them at a margin, and you're trying to encourage everybody who's involved in your organisation to maximise their sales. And that's how it all works. So although it's very simple, and yet we're sat here today because we have concerns that that model isn't working any longer the way that it should. We're sat here knowing that in the UK it takes 3 days for the French to produce the same output as it takes the UK 4 days. We're sat here knowing that in those stats it's a retail sector that's one of the biggest drag factors on UK productivity. So I was sort of wondering why that might be the case, because I thought we'd solved all the challenges that face the UK industry. You know, we've got the most flexible and agile workforce in Europe. We don't have industrial relations challenges anymore. So how do it be that we have the worst productivity? How is that possible? And it seems a little bit like the medical profession that we have gone from fixing, you know, sitting out of Europe, and yet we found that there's another disease. And that the new vicious disease is that of poor productivity. We are the lowest in the G7. And as I said at the start, this is a huge competitive threat to the UK economy. And given that the number of people that are employed in retail, the size of the retail sector and its contribution to the UK economy, it's clear that the productivity puzzle, if it's going to be solved, that this area of research and the work that we're going to be doing provides a really important link to understanding what that's all about. And so what we're hoping to do as a task force is to really find a new productivity equation for the UK. Thinking about equations, it was Einstein, I think, who said, you can't solve new problems with old thinking. So the question, I think, for this panel is how do we introduce new thinking so that we can come at these forming issues in a new way. I'm personally a great believer in looking at things in other places and seeing how they work and whether you can transport those. What seems like radical ideas in one sector are sort of well accepted in others, and see whether through that work we can come up with some fresh perspectives. On that topic, I thought I'd share some stories from a benchmarking trip I conducted a few years ago to the United States to look at what people were looking at trends and doing things differently. A couple of those retailers stuck in my mind and I thought I'd just share some of those stories to perhaps illustrate some of the kinds of areas that we might focus on in this review. One of them you may have heard of is a retailer called Wegmans. It's renowned in the United States for its fresh food, its innovation, and its store friendliness. I went there with a number of colleagues while they were all looking at how you run an efficient vegetable section. I was talking to the people who were responsible for the people in the business. And it was a way that they ran the people operations that really struck me. One of the most interesting things that happens in a Wegmans store is that when the senior managers come in and visit, the first question that they ask isn't how's your sales, or how's your customer satisfaction, or even how's the latest promotion going. The first question that they ask is, who left last month? And they then go into the ins and outs of why they have turnover on any department, because they treat each person in their business as special. This isn't just because they're a caring operation, as they clearly are. It's because they know that people drive the performance of a retail business. Now, they have low turnover, and I think that's absolutely critical, because they feel that the people behind counters are the people who get to know people who shop in those stores, the people who build up the trust both in the products and the brand, and ultimately they believe that that loyalty is what differentiates them from their competition. An incredibly successful business, but a very different model of productivity to that which we see in parts of the UK. Another retailer that stood out is Publix. Publix are described in the United States as the Walmart slayer. They're the only retailer who managed to keep Walmart out of the turkey, like the very dominant player in the southeast of the United States. And Walmart really haven't managed to penetrate that part of the US. So, in my mind, and having worked in retail, anybody who can compete with Walmart and keep them out is worth looking at. And they're very interesting because they've got a model that really does outperform. It's more responsive, it's better. Customer satisfaction is more distinctive than most retailers. It's supposed to be the best for customer satisfaction in the US. But what's really interesting is it has the best sales per square foot figures of any retailer in the US and one of the highest in the world. And they do that in part because they're an employee-owned business. Every single person feels that they've got a stake in the business. They treat it like that. They know the hard facts of what competition looks like, and they are adaptive enough to take responsibility and make the decisions that are needed to compete on that basis. And the reason for giving that as an example is it's just another way of looking at productivity. They manage to do it in a very, very different way, and yet they're competing head-on with an organisation with far bigger scale, far better buying power, and yet they're managing to hold their own. So there are different ways of looking at productivity, and these are just examples of different things that exist in retail. And I would suggest, you know, we extend the survey into other parts of industry. If you contrast that to the way in which most people in the retail sector think about productivity today, They think of it just in terms of pure retail cost effectiveness. What's the labour cost that's going into the performance of this store? And that's why we see in the UK this sort of over-decreasing surplus of people working shorter and shorter hours, trying to flex and fit in with staff rostering systems which perfectly match customer footfall. And that whole model is what's driving, I think, a very different way of managing labour costs. What it results in is people being de-skilled, because how do you upskill, and what's the point anyway, upskilling people who have jobs that are only for a few hours a week. And that de-skilling of the workforce is part of a more general push towards casualisation, so you have a completely different relationship with your workforce. So that has been a model, I think, that's come to the fore over the last 5 years, and with movement towards national living wage, it has to be a clear concern that we will see even more of that type of behaviour. So for me, that thinking, traditional though it may be, is creating ever diminishing returns. I'm not trying to criticise the retail sector, because I know, having worked in it, that it deals with some really harsh realities. Fighting off the twin threats today of both online at one and discount retailers at another, it's very difficult. But I really do believe that the role of this task force is to challenge that conventional thinking. So, lots of conversations really do come down to how do we take labour costs out. The other concern that was mentioned by Alvin is that the answer to that question may well be, well, let's just use technology then. If you visited any major supermarket, then you'll notice that the banks of self-scanning machines are approaching further and further down the checkout aisles. If you combine that with a move to online retailing, you see some people thinking that that is a perfect way of delivering an absolutely core productive model. If you're in Ocado or Amazon, you're thinking about how you can eliminate the use of labour altogether in food and services departments. And yet, there is a different way of looking at things. I think that with technology, there's a perspective that you can take that, and I think some retailers are starting to see this, that that isn't all what customers are looking for. People like to talk to people. They like the process of browsing physically, of touching, trying, tasting products, and talking to staff about that experience. It's a social phenomenon as well as an economic one. And I think we need to look at those factors and understand and develop an understanding of what productivity means in a broader sense, so that retailing is seen as a pleasure, not just a chore. We see that today, and I know that by sector you can, you know, there are different economic drivers, but for anybody who's been to the Apple store on Regent Street, the interesting thing about that store is that it loses money. In fact, there are no Apple stores around the world that make money. But they work because they support the Apple brand. And they support the Apple brand because they give a real connection between people and the product and the customers. And people have an opportunity to experience an Apple in the brand. And that builds loyalty to the organization, to the brand, and people want to keep on coming back. It's interesting to know that the people who work in those stores are called geniuses and not sales assistants. And that gives us an insight into some of the other dimensions of productivity that we're also considering. The dimensions that says, you know, there's a different way of looking at work. And technology has been finding things throughout the retail chain. If you think about organisations like Etsy, have used technology to interact or enable interaction between people and products and manufacturers in a completely different way that only a few years ago we would have never thought possible. that online experiences means that people can get a really rich experience because they're talking directly to the manufacturer of that product. And they can specify and have that interaction. Now that's a minority sport at the moment, but who knows where that's going to go. And the richness of that's bringing both to customer experience and also to the people working in that supply chain, I think also provides us with some very interesting insights. These cases are only the tip of an iceberg that I think is, as we've discussed at Davos in the past week, got a little large on our horizons. The risks of mass job losses are significant. But it could equally at the same time, we share the dynamics of the market in a positive way. We are starting to see the first evidence of what a sharing economy might do. How is this going to impact the way in which we tell what's to happen? And what people come to expect of the retail experience? And how will that impact the way in which the larger retailers think that their operations should be run? All I'm trying to do here is to illustrate that there are a number of different ways that we can think about productivity and pay. It's not just a narrow sense, and it would be key, in my mind, to changing how we define the productivity equation that you get. Just to finish then, so we've talked so far about productivity in an economic sense, but we're also perhaps rediscovering that prosperity, that productivity is really stratified in a broader way. Productivity, in my view, is a big driver of prosperity, as Cameron was highlighting in his opening remarks. But I mean prosperity in a broader sense. I mean prosperity in the sense that people have a good job, they value and have a sense of dignity in what they do, and they get paid in a way that means that they can live lives that are both healthy and satisfying. So productivity has a bigger impact, and I'm struck by those connections, because in my mind, the work that people do does matter. The job is more than the pay packet. We need to think about, and we will in this task force, about the way in which people can have a decent life. The importance of working that, I think, starts with having a good job. It should be possible for anybody to be able to get a good job and to be able to work at it. And through that, we know that people get a sense of dignity and self-worth and a place in the community. I think that every single human being should be entitled to that, and we need to understand this productivity equation such that it really is thinking about work in its broadest sense and its broadest role. So we need to think about how we design jobs so that they're building skills, the experience and relationships that people need to have a fulfilling life, and to remind ourselves that a good job, a reliable job, is one of the main reasons why we have a stable society. It's the fibre that holds everything together. I was listening to a Joe Biden speech at Davos the other day. I'll try to do a bad American accent now. He said, no middle class, no vibrant economy. So, you know, the challenges that we're talking about, I think, are really to the heart of what a vibrant economy is all about. So we have to find new solutions to the productivity challenge. Wages have been stagnating. To get wages moving again, we have to get productivity moving. That challenge we know is hitting retailers front and centre now with the introduction of national living wage. I think what it marks is the end of the era of cheap, flexible and disposable people. So we need to rethink the productivity equation. We need to do it now, and that is very much the challenge that we're putting at the heart of this task force. We will be looking for the input of all retailers, of experts from both within and outside the sector, and of people working on the front line to get their perspective on what productivity means for them. We think we can do things differently. We're going to come up with some answers, hopefully, in this task force, which sets out how and why. Thank you.
Fantastic, Norman. Thank you so much. So just before we open it up to all of you, I'd like to invite any of the Task Force members who would like to make any remarks very briefly themselves about their interest in their project and you know, what they're hoping to bring. So, if you want to start, if you'd like to.
I'm Jill Ruby. I'm a professor at the Alliance Managers Business School in the University of Manchester. I come to this task force with a lifelong interest in the whole issue of low wages and minimum wages. I think I wrote a book in 1982 arguing for a national minimum wage at the time at which the trade unions were still actually quite keen on abolishing wages councils, which set minimum wages in sectors such as retail. And I've been following this issue all my life, so it's very important. I have a parallel interest and commitment to issues about the gender pay gap. And I think it's obvious that we cannot do anything about closing the gender pay gap. We do not do something about raising the relative pay in feminized sectors such as social care, retail, and hospitality, etc. So this is a challenge that I think we have to address if we are to have a more equal and inclusive society, a more gender equal society. But as I work in a business school, and I'm a columnist by origin and training, I'm obviously very not only concerned with, but also interested in the way in which companies can adjust to these changes in wage structures and embed more higher levels of wages and more investment in people in different kinds of business models. And I think what's challenging for this task force is that the adjustment to the announcement to the announced increase in the national minimum wage to £7.20 from April is only apparent at the start of the process. This is going to continue to rise, and it seems to me that this is the time for British businesses, trade unions, and wider society to come together to think about how to embed a different approach to labour, not the cheap, flexible, disposable people, often women, as their model, and to move to more progressive, find ways to move to more progressive model. But of course, that's not an easy task. We do have to look at areas of online retailers, perhaps in their distribution networks, who are not necessarily facing the same challenges, and to think about the wider context of whether retailers need to be supported in making those transitions. So those are my interests.
Jill, thank you very much.
Yes, hi. My name is Pia Wiggles. I'm head of research and economics at the trade union of Worcester. We represent 440,000 members in the retail industry, significant number of those actually work in retail. Our main concern and my involvement in this task force is to ensure that the voice of workers is heard. Often workers in the productivity equation and often their voice is not taken into consideration, the concerns they have not considered. It's extremely important. We have a strong interest in ensuring the industry is successful and provides jobs and secures the ground members, of course. But it's unrealistic to expect workers who are not even making decent pay to afford to live to really be thinking about productivity and being the best. There's a great deal of part-time employment in retail, but if you look under the surface, you find that it's often women who are working in two or three jobs. Actually, it does add up to a full-time job, but they can't get the hours of a full-time job that they need, so they're working in a series of part-time jobs. So flexibility is really, really important, and that's flexibility that works both ways, which enables both the employee to be able to have the flexible hours they need to mix up with their domestic and other responsibilities, whether it's studying or childcare or healthcare. And also, we need to ensure that we secure flexibility of skills. So often in the retail industry, the focus is on the worker being flexible in their hours, but of course, there is better attention given to support to increase the range of skills and experience of work that could be more flexibility on both sides of the equation. So, Rose Borsador and also John Hannett, our General Secretary, who can't be here today, to do much with the latest problem for retail workers, i.e. The sort of trading issue of the ridiculous attempt to expand some trading hours without any consideration of workforce in the industry. But if he were here, he would actually say that the most important thing is the voice of retail workers is heard, and John and I will be making sure that happens on the task force.
Thank you.
very much. And yes.
Thank you. My name is Joe Drogi. I'm head of policy research at the IPA. It struck me when Norman was talking about our position in terms of the G7 on productivity, so we're second bottom of the G7, which is still considered, as Ken said, since I think 2007-2008. It reminded me of David Cameron's favourite team, Aston Villa, who, you know, we used to be world-beating champions in Europe, and now we are the perennial underachievers near the bottom of the league table. And the same story on productivity goes for employee involvement. So if you look at the European Trade Union Institute, they do an index of involvement at work, which looks at involvement at the enterprise level, at the workplace level, and through collective bargaining. And we are second bottom of the EU, beaten only by Lithuania. So employees at work in the UK tend to really struggle to have a voice at work. I venture that many of us here might not experience that in our daily lives because it is strongly linked both to skills level and to class, sadly. If you look at the workplace employee relations study, just one in three employees in the UK say that their manager is good at allowing them to influence decisions at work. So as well as struggling on productivity, we struggle with voice. But I mean, why am I talking about voice involvement apart from the fact that the involvement and participation association looks at those topics? It's because there's a really strong evidence link between voice at work and productivity, both on an individual level and on an organisational level. So it must be a big cause of concern, and there must be links that be strong on productivity and on involvement. There's also evidence that involvement is particularly low in retail, as with the lot of lower skilled sectors. And this is certainly linked to the challenges that retail has in terms of productivity and pay. And in one sense, it's obvious, really, that involvement and voice is linked to productivity. Because productivity, as Cameron said, is essentially a measure of output, the union input, with labor productivity, obviously, the union input being labor. So getting the most out of your staff matters for productivity. They're the ones who know the services and products you provide, the processes that work or don't work within your organisation, and the customers that you serve. They are an immense and often untapped source of innovation and ideas for improving things at work. And when people are involved at work, as Norman said, when people feel they have a stake, they're more motivated and more productive. So we think involvement and participation is really important to addressing the work. It's a great shame that fixing the foundations of the government's solution to productivity barely mentions the workplace at all, and only mentions trade unions as a challenge rather than a part of the government.
So I'm Daniel Johnson, and as Andy introduced, this is a great opportunity for me because I am both a retailer and also a parliamentary candidate for Scottish Parliament for the Labour Party. So I spent most of my life struggling to balance my role as an aspiring politician and a shopkeeper, and this allows me to do those with great ease. So it's wonderful to be able to do that. But I think I'm hoping to bring maybe three different perspectives. First and foremost, I run a small retail business. We employ approximately 25 people, and we were the first independent retailer in Edinburgh to become an accredited living wage employer. I think the challenges which I think this agenda poses for small and medium-sized retailers are quite distinct, not entirely different, but they're certainly more distinct to larger and especially more vertically integrated retailers. So I'm hoping to provide some insight from that perspective. I'm also hoping to provide something of a non-London Scottish perspective, and I think in our remarks before this meeting, that was one of the things we talked about, is that the challenges faced by urban retailers as opposed to non-urban retailers are potentially different. And I think having a look at that and the differences there are regionally across the UK are really important. But finally, I think that retail is an industry which has, I think, really been at the very forefront of the challenges and disruption caused by technology. Online retail has been a great shaping force for retailers over the last few years. And that's a pace of change which isn't going away. So I think that we're at a real crossroads. I think it's a crossroads both in terms of making sure that we can bring about a fairer workplace and better pay for all people within the retail industry. There's also about embracing change and technological change. And I think that, if you get those things right, the benefits are there for both and people employed within the retail industry and for retailers themselves. I think the potential is a virtuous circle, which I think as Morgan was outlining in his remarks, is really what we are looking for here. And I think, above all else, I think those challenges are ones which are not unique to the retail industry. I think there are lessons here across the private sector. As we look to the future and the changes that automation are undoubtedly going to bring, as I like to say, you know, at the moment when our deliveries arrive at our shop, it's a man with a van and a pallet that's coming out the back. In 10 years' time, I don't think there'll be a man, and I think the pallet might take itself off the back of the van and deliver itself. And the challenges and change that will bring are going to be profound, and I think we need to embrace them, not try to do them.
Thank you, Daniel. Right, over to you. We want to pump a room of experts for your ideas, your insights, and a bit of steer. You know, having heard the terms of reference that you know we set ourselves, some of the backgrounds of our task force members, what do you think we should be focusing on? So it would be fantastic to hear any contributions that are both, you know, sort of where you're coming from individually or as an organisation, but also what you think our task force should be asking. And as you come in, Dev, can you say who you are and where you're from as well?
Hi, I'm Andy Callan from the British Retail Consortium, and a huge congratulations, it's a great project, and it's really great for the three organisations to be working together, and I do think you've got it spot on. So customer service, flexibility, and technology, I think, are the areas where retail is special and different. I don't want to repeat any of the brilliant points that have already been made, because they're very much a part of the narrative that we share. So I wonder if I could just step back a little bit and look at the very broad context in which we find ourselves, and also the kind of the way in which we're having to weave through government policy at the moment. Because I think maybe something that we need to bring to the fore that possibly government hasn't quite got at the moment is that actually we're on a burning platform here. The combination of the digital revolution, the squeeze, the financial squeeze that the government's putting on the sector through business rates, through the apprenticeship levy, through the national living wage, could mean that up to 1 billion jobs go in the near future, in certainly very strongly connected with retail supply chain. And it kind of depends on government how they choose to work through some of their policies, whether we get to that terrible burning platform position, or we come out the other end with possibly fewer people employed in the industry, but with much better jobs and with generally a higher wage and better progression. So I'll just give one example of the national threat, which is if you look at the apprenticeship levy, the government has committed to going 3 million people into apprenticeships. And the very particular way in which they asked us to be engaged with that. And yet they are kind of pulling the carpet from under the feet of retail, who are already very good at training people, by saying that we must use external training facilities, and nobody, unless they're Ofsted covered, can do the training, which immediately creates quite a lot of difficulty in how you bring people into the industry. So how are we going to solve that problem? We will go with solutions, but that's just one tiny problem. And I know the government's very fixated in bringing young people into work, but actually young people don't have a problem getting into retail. We go around and poof them up because they're great and they're brilliant and they want to progress. The problem is precisely the people Fiona's talking about who are stuck, who cannot progress their careers. And I'm not entirely sure that some of the policies around apprenticeships, for example, get that. So we need to kind of get them away from pushing us onto this burning platform at the moment, or we are going to end up in serious trouble. But really pleased to see the launch today, it's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Right, so I saw some other hands, so it's
my friend. Hi, my name is Izzy Hatfield, and I'm a research fellow at the RPR. And we're also doing some work in this area, and we're really interested to see what comes out of this because of that. We're looking at the low wage sector, so it's a bit more broad, it's retail and it's hospitality, and social care, amongst some other ones. I just wanted to share with you a tiny little bit of the analysis we've done, which tries to something come up saying about the international productivity gap. I think we have this idea that in Germany maybe they're much more productive because they have a big manufacturing sector, and that's just how it is. But we've been looking at the low wage sectors in particular, and we found that all across Europe, countries where there's a big productivity gap, which let's face it, is most of the kind of leading economies we're lagging behind them. We found that the productivity levels in the low wage sectors are a really key contribution to that gap. So, for example, if we raised our productivity in the UK's low wage sectors and kept the same amount of hours worked in them to the same levels that France have in those sectors, like retail, etc., we could close 40% of our productivity gap with France. So, it's not really just that other countries in Europe have less people working in services than we do, or focus more on high-skilled manufacturing. I mean, some of it probably is to do with that, with the overall productivity picture, but the low-wage sectors are really, really important to the gap as well, which is why I'm really interested in it. So yeah, I just wanted to share that with you, and we'll be working on it too. I'm really keen to see what comes out of this. So.
Fantastic, thank you very much.
Luke Creamer, I'm from Unite. I have a lot of feedback at the moment with employers like Sports Direct, how they are treating their workforce. I think when we're looking at a whole sector, we have to recognise some of the ends of that sector, because in a competitive market where costs are important, have people who are cutting costs in ways which most moral companies would find abhorrent, they need to be factored into this and dealt with within it. Otherwise, it will only bring everyone else down to that level, because we're in a competitive market. We have situations within like Sports Direct where 75% of their workforce are on 0 hours in retail. In their logistics centres, almost 100%, 4,000 people, our agency workers. What this then means is that people are so unbelievably scared because they have six strikes in rank. You bring up, because you're sick, that's a strike against your name. Spend a few dollars in the toilet, that's a strike against your name. These are not people who are, at the moment, going to be able to engage in anything, because they won't have confidence to do that, because they're on a precarious employment, which means, although not unlawful in its own right, leaves them no ability to raise anything, to challenge anything, to contribute, which is obviously going to have a significant effect on productivity.
Great, thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Claire McCarthy from the Cooperative Party. I suppose it wouldn't surprise you to hear me say this, but one of the things that I would think might be interesting is different ownership models. And so obviously in retail, clearly the PLC is dominant, but there are large businesses operating under other ownership models. Waitrose and John Lewis and smaller retailers like Super as employee-owned businesses, and clearly the cooperative as a consumer-owned cooperative structure, and obviously also still some quite large family businesses. I think Clark's is still family-owned and others. I suppose I'd be interested, and in the way it draws quite heavily on some of the things Joe was saying, to what extent the ownership structure creates any differentials in some of this, but also I guess particularly as that pertains then to issues around involvement. Are some types of businesses better at employee involvement, and also I guess issues maybe related to profit sharing, some of those, the ways in which it's remuneration or benefits. So I guess I'm just urging the task force to potentially think about some of those issues around ownership models within the work that you're doing. But it's, I mean, I think it's a great project, and congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
David Coates. Sorry for being late. Two quick points. I think there is a measurement question here, which we will need to spend a lot of time worrying about. Measuring productivity in services generally, he is problematic, but Jill has probably said most of it pretty worried about that. I was encouraged by Robert Roman's basically trying to redefine what we mean by performance in the retail sector. Because conventional measures of productivity don't really capture anything about the customer experience. And that's what we can say. The second is, leaving those measurement questions on one side for the moment, there may be some other factors, which Karen may have mentioned, and you did, I apologize for raising them again. But it does seem to me that geography is really important here. The US has a significant productivity advantage in not just retail, but in ICT using sectors, which many analysts attribute to the fact that it's a big country with a fairly dispersed population, which means that you can have bigger trucks on emptier roads delivering to bigger supermarkets with wider aisles. So you can therefore make more efficient, beautiful logistics system to improve the overall productivity of the sector. Now, those advantages are much harder to secure in a country like the UK, where we have a sort of concentrated population, busy roads and smaller trucks. Than, you know. If you've seen an articulate lorry come to deliver to your Tesco local, you know. So if that is right, then that is a kind of inevitable spatial constraint for what we could do in the UK, which then seems to me takes you straight to Joe's points about the organisation of work, the design of jobs, and the engagement of the workforce, because that's where the innovation works if you can't. If you can't do it just using technology and geography.
Thank you.
And
hi, I'm
Diana Mitch,
I'm a senior researcher at the Recruitment and Employment Federation. My first job for the organisation this summer was to write a report on pay and progression in the labour sectors, one of which was retail. So I went out and I spoke to focus groups of agency workers. And one of the things that came up was the tension that they have between themselves and their permanent counterparts. A lot of them had chosen the nature of the work because it's flexible and fit around their lifestyles, around their studying, etc. But they felt they weren't getting the same opportunities and the same treatment by their employers as their permanent counterparts. And they felt disincentivized to actually raise their productivity level by pushing around the incentivization of two different types of staff.
It's pretty helpful, thank you. Yeah, I'm Bob. I wrote the labour policy paper on the pay for the small job forms announcement of the social national workforce and society as our experience. Just one observation, I'm very pleased you're coming in from the productivity end rather than the pay end. That's refreshing. Then three thoughts. One, I hope you will shine a light on the national living wage and show it for what it is. Because obviously the real living wage takes account of benefits, whereas lots of it doesn't. And he's coupled it with the interpretive universal credits with the first government customs. Back to the original minimum wage, and meanwhile, having caused sufficient confusion to lay line the Living Wage Foundation, assuming a real minimum wage very, very difficult. Yeah. I know from where I said that was a very confusing set of sentences, and he's agreed to that environment. So I think there's a real mission to show what some support it is. Secondly, just a plea not to duck the jobs question, and I feel a bit in my work, maybe. Was, I might have done that. And sometimes this is about improved service, but sometimes it is about technology and replacing people. And sometimes I hate that, and sometimes actually I prefer it. So please take that head on, because I think it's a huge challenge. And then thirdly, and I'm sure you'll get this, this is a moving target, so you can spend all your time worrying about the existing retailers and not worry about the retail environment in 5 or 10 years' time. Published time, there might be a chance that your work will be implemented. The route to online, I think, is only just you, and you can spend all your time on the high street and in your work, you might be 10 years' time. But I think my first point to make one, this looks wonderful, so I think you're focusing on the real issue, which is productivity and paying public.
Thank you very much. Anyone else like to? Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, it's Paul Sowens, TUC policy officer, and one time in retail and two in the supermarket, the last century. So today, I mean, just to welcome the project, which I think is timely. It's right on money, property, more probably in other sectors. Everybody's starting to worry about governments, probably what we should do at this moment. Retail is a good sector to start in, and to me, we've been thinking about productivity in retail, even if we didn't have a digital sector, because we've now got a tightly labour market, down 5.1% of employment, so it's going further down. There won't be an ability to pick workers right off the shelf and fill retail jobs in coming years. So we'd be thinking about productivity in retail, even if there was no digital revolution. And how do we treat people in relations at work is probably part of that equation, because it can't be more about to Tories need to steal from. It has also to be about how we treat people at work, both as individuals and as groups. Because otherwise, if we get it wrong, we take the loops out, we work for Sports Direct. If you want to unlock the gold in the workers' heads and have a bad idea, you work for Sports Direct. I'm sure you're going to keep it yourself.
Yes,
thanks.
My name is
Katie
from Frontier. Just a bit of a plea on two copies, through on the passports, which is brilliant, to also not just look at evidence around this, but to look at strategy with employers. I think we've kind of brought up lots of stuff, like great evidence already almost proving this point. The thing around strategy about influencing employers seems really lacking, basically. Business case seems almost there, if not already there, but none of us quite know how to persuade businesses to take it on varying sizes and locations. So yeah, please use this opportunity to do that as well.
Yeah, yeah, that will be a big point in some sort of second half of the project, so thank you for making that point.
Stephen Stern, and Norman, you paraphrased, whether consciously or not, Sir Frank Hertzberg, psychologist who said, if you want people to do a good job, give them a good job to do, they're quite difficult for people to raise productivity. And David's point about work organisation, if they're just not given a good job, or if they're someone like Sports Director being demotivated and told in a way that the employer isn't interested in you doing a good job. There's also, I agree also with David's point about productivity. It's a very slippery concept, which I suppose really comes from manufacturing originally, and teaching unions or the health unions have taken starting to talk about productivity in their world, it's quite a silly conversation potentially. So I just echo David's point about trying to be clear what we need, and it's probably something to do with this business of having a good job, the quality of the job.
I want to give everybody the chance to speak if they wish to, but I also don't want to make anyone feel awkward that they have to. Does anyone want to make any more comments? That's all been incredibly helpful. So what I'm going to do is ask any of our panelists who wish to respond to any of those remarks to do so, and then I'll give the last opportunity to Norman. Julie, would you like to?
I didn't want to speak earlier, but now I'll listen to everything. My name is Hugh Abraham, I'm the head of salaries at Which Sounds. We're accredited for the real living wage, not the living wage, the other living wage. And it's something we've worked very hard on over the last few years to get that accreditation, and we've done a lot of work on that. And I'm here because I'm passionate about the people working in retail. We've shown it can be done, and one thing I can say, as much as my salary bill has gone up, earnings and pensions are able to go in the same direction. And which proves if they've got the right job and the right incentives and they're treated, they've got a voice, we've done this, and I'd really like to see how far we can push it across. Look, I think it's difficult, you know, we're owned by one person, we can turn on sixpence, we can change our minds every day if we want to, but we can work like that, which is going to be more difficult when you've got shareholders. But as far as we're concerned, there is no profit about our people, so that's where I'm coming. And I applaud if I know the Sports Direct from old, and yeah, people like that should be driven out, and the people who do treat their staff right should be able to remain afterwards.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
just very briefly, I think it's quite clear that paying people appropriately in support of work leads to increased productivity. It's also clear that recognising unions, particularly employee voice, increases productivity. So I think we've got some very positive places to start, and just thank you for the contributions you've made, because you've added into the debate for having amongst ourselves to move forward and tackle this issue. Thank you.
Okay, and on this side.
Yeah, so I'll just pick up on David's point about geography and to make a slightly different point. When we came to this, I was somewhat concerned about a focus on productivity that's often understood very narrowly with respect to the organisations and not about the global veto or the wider driver of the society. And it seems to me that we do face major challenges about maintaining lively and coherent communities in terms of often. Technological changes that might lead to more online shopping, and as well as these other challenges about that were eloquently described, and all these challenges in terms of pay and apprenticeship charges, etc. So I think the geography is actually vital, and also working and living now on the sort of so-called Northern Powerhouse, you know. Manchester's success, I think, is largely about having a vibrant city centre. And I think, therefore, retail is much bigger than simply the issue of product output per hour of labour. It is actually something vital to think about for the future of the society as a whole.
That's
really helpful. I mean, just briefly, I think, again, linking to that, and I think. The comments about productivity very much echo the discussion we were having before the meeting. That in retail, you don't have widgets per hour that you can easily manage, and that actually a lot of this would be sort of rather crudely we're talking about is as much qualitative as quantitative. And I think in retail, that connected to some of the other comments, I think as it works extremes, retail work in a very distant hour. And actually you can do things really functionally, I think, make people's roles richer, ask them to do more, and therefore they're more productive in that sense. So I think that's something that will be a real focus in just within my own business. The challenge from online is being part met by asking our staff to not just serve customers at the counter, but also, can they help us manage our online catalogue? Creating up some of our own staff to take photographs of our product images for our websites, etc. And I think there's discussion about that, making people's jobs richer, giving them more empowerment, which I think we can talk about. And then, but I just want to mention briefly, I think one of the structures I think is a really interesting point. And certainly one of the my trite little phrases, but actually it can mean something that I like talking about, is that not necessarily every business can be cooperative, but I think all businesses should strive to be more cooperative. And I think in our business, what I've striven to do in the last 5 or so years is make sure that we have no secrets. And that's not completely possible, but as much as possible, we can try to provide maximum information and let everyone know what's going on and discuss the decisions which are being made in the business. So in that sense, we strive to be a little more productive. And I think there are things like that which I think can definitely be discussed, as well as the more formal structures of mutual ownership versus, private companies, etc.
Thank you. I just wanted to respond to the point on technology and its impact on replacing employment, which was raised by Aaron, by the gentleman there. It's a very personal point, particularly in retail, which I think is more vulnerable if you look at it from the impact of employees, or right, from the impact of automators to the impact here. The IPO releasing a report tomorrow on involvement and productivity. One of Paul's colleagues, Janet Williamson from the TUC, has written something for it. And I just wanted to pick out one of her points, which she made, which is that a study by Alex Bryson showed in the private sector showed that managerial-led innovation was actually associated with lower work and well-being, except for when there's collective bargaining in the workplace. His conclusion was that unions oil the wheels of change, make employees less threatened by technological developments. And it struck me that if you're working at Sports Direct and you have that sort of golden mind, as you put it, you're certainly not going to come up with that. You think it's going to impact on your employment. So
I think that's a strong case for involvement in that sense for trade unions. And I think many employers in the sector do get that. There's some good partnership working with our store and some of the large retailers. Unfortunately, that hasn't seemed to have escaped the government given the productivity plan and the trade union bill. I should say that the idea that beyond the trade union involvement across the piece, and the publication act tomorrow does that, but there's some clearly strong evidence that trade unions can support effective change in the workplace.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of come back on the measurement point, because clearly, you know, if this wasn't as complex as it is, there wouldn't be this productivity puzzle where everyone's sort of struggling with that. Clearly, measurement, the definition, are going to be definition rather than measurement are going to be big issues. And it's a lot of what we talked about this morning, what is productivity. And that's why it's really great to have the comments that we have, which are very, very useful. I think certainly when we look at good work or progressive employment practice, however you want to define it, I'm sure that's something we'll do, there's clearly a lot of great examples that we can look at and champion. You know, on the one hand, you've got the sports directors and others that we might want to call into question, but on the other hand, there are plenty of great examples, and Daniel and Julia are two of those, where employers are wanting to do the right thing and doing it. And so I think a key part of this is to be able to pick out those, and that's why it's great to sort of get comments and open up this as wide as possible to get some feedback and feedback.
Norman, final word of the I think a very interesting day, the quality of the conversation, the breadth of the conversation has been hugely helpful. I think we are in a great position at a very important time to conduct this task force investigation into productivity. The one point I would add to the conversation, which has been very rich, was for me, this is about exerting influence on the retail sector. There's no point in doing this with yourselves as another report on a shelf. But again, there will be lots of reports on productivity over the coming months and years. So how we exert influence on the retail sector, I think it's one of the most important things that we need to think about. And to that end, I think it's going to be very important that we can work with the sector on exploring these issues over the coming months. And so I'm delighted to see that the BRC is there. And would hope that we can work with you in trying to really explore the issues that are associated with this. Because it's important that we get that engagement up front so that there's an interest and not just an audience and there's a report at the end of it. And the same would go with the trade union movements and other representative bodies of workers, that we need to have that voice in the room as well, because the objective of doing this work is that we influence real change. So with your help, I'm sure we will.
Thank you very much, Norman. And I should just say the next step, so just sort of the start of that process, is having had today's event, we will be having a series of evidence hearings, which will be open to stakeholders, anyone who wants to participate. We'll be having some workshops with retailers, experts, and employees, and there'll be an open call for evidence. So please stay involved in the project in any way you wish to. We really want to tap into the expertise of everyone involved in this debate. Thank you very much for your attendance today. I'm going to go to the next one.